This is Dave Schmidt, and I'm delighted to have with me Tim Kelly, the host of Tim Kelly 67, which manifests itself in two series, one Our Interesting Times, and the other one Powers and Principalities with Joe Atwell. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yes. Some of my listeners may just be getting familiar with you tonight. Is there anything that you'd like to mention about your particular perspectives on things and why you're doing the podcast that you do?
Well, I started doing it, I guess, 6 years ago. Was it that long? 6 years? I just started doing the program because I think I listened to a lot of material, other podcasts and programs in the previous years, particularly after maybe 2007 when podcasting really picked up. I figured if I started my own program, I could talk to some of these people, their books, their articles, and you know, like reach out to them. And as the technology allowed for it, I decided to sort of, leap the technical hurdles, and start my own program and talk to people, talk to authors and researchers and other podcasters and start these conversations because I felt right around, after 2005, it became increasingly clear to me that something was definitely wrong. And I've always taken a sort of a, not always, but going back in the 90s, sort of taken a revisionist view of history. Obviously, my opinion of these events have developed and evolved as I have come across more information. And so I, you know, the podcasting platform enabled me to sort of start this vanity project. You know, it's also a form of therapy too, because it enables you to talk to people about these things other than, you know, talking to the mirror,
right.
You know, or getting in fights or discussions with family around Christmas or Easter or Thanksgiving. I could have these discussions. Of course, my program isn't really a debating platform. My interview program, Our Interesting Times, is dedicated to like inviting people on and talking about their research, and not so much debating, although there's sometimes a little there. But usually just to present their ideas. And of course, Powers and Principalities is sort of I think it's clear it's an unrehearsed, just a back and forth with Joe. It was kind of his idea.
Right.
And so I agreed to do it. Now I think we're coming up on almost 200 shows now. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I have to say that I'm extremely grateful to your Oprah. To use the fancy word, I've probably heard almost all of your productions, at least let's say the ones going back to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to wake up around 2008. I mean, I always had, curiosity in different views of the world, but around 2008 or so, I started very seriously questioning the dominant narrative, and I'll tell you, I went through an interesting little process of whistleblowing myself, and I found myself in that very hard place that whistleblowers do, and your show was an absolute comfort to me, along with many other things and many other books, too. But the point that I'm trying to make for the audience is that as you get a clearer picture of the world, that is reality, as painful as it is, it's actually comforting and sort of deeply healing to get a hold of that. So thank you.
Oh, you're certainly welcome.
The world is absolutely immersed in this issue of COVID, the vaccine. Some people and also the virus. Some people wonder how real the virus is or is not. But at any rate, it's thrown the whole world, not only our own nation, but the whole world into a turmoil, unlike anything ever seen, I think it's accurate to say, in the history of humankind.
Yeah, I'd liken it as maybe a people of maybe the First World War, the Second World War. Although in that situation, there were real events occurring. I mean, there were mass movement of troops, cities being bombed, and real death. Whereas this is more of a construct, I think, than it is an actual pandemic. And pandemics are always kind of like this. Always a question of how you interpret it. The data, and of course, at least in my opinion, the data sets have not provided for anything close to what most people would think would be a global pandemic. Most people associate that with, you know, sharp increases in death and illnesses, and this really hasn't occurred. And so it seems to me that it was an operation, and a psychological operation that was implemented, late 2019, early 2020. After all, it was a tabletop exercise, Event 201, which was conducted by the very people who were very involved in the response to the pandemic. So there's good reasons to be suspicious of not only of its validity or real existence. One can infer a lot of agendas behind this, and at this point, it's clear that it isn't a public health crisis. This is a psychological operation that's to facilitate a radical agenda to change the way we live and how we live, and actually what we are as organisms themselves. If you believe, yes. If you were to follow the rhetoric of one Klaus Schwab and these technocrats, these transhumanist technocrats. You know, they were having a field day with this crisis.
And it seems to be facilitated as well by the existence of a third group, in addition to the skeptics and the promoters of COVID and or the vaccine. There is a group characterized by people like Dr. Scott Atlas from Stanford, Victor Davis Hanson, also from Stanford, a military historian, and others who are generally icons on the right or in conservative circles. And yet these people add to this narrative, at least that there is a very serious pandemic, and that we're very thankful for the vaccines. I'm looking, as we're waiting for the show to start, I was looking at this Primus publication that has Scott Atlas in it, and he even refers to the 500,000 dead.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another group. And also, you and I are both Catholics, and so we experience that sort of early rollout of the tribulation.
Yes.
oddly enough, I assume that it's true where you are as well. The Catholic diocese and the parishes sort of outdo the civil authorities in earnestness, if not draconian measures, implementing draconian measures. So maybe we can look at that and the participation of that in the creation of this propaganda event.
Yeah, early on, I think the surrender of the abdication of responsibility of the Catholic bishops when they agreed to shut down the churches in the March of 2020, And, you know, they even canceled, stopped Easter services. This is the holiest day of the Christian calendar, the Holy Week, because of the crisis. And they pretty much admitted that, although your grocery stores could stay open, churches couldn't. And what they were saying was that, grocery shopping is more essential than receiving the sacraments. So they're admitting their own obsolescence in a way, by agreeing to that. They weren't forced to shut down. They agreed to shut down. They didn't confront the politicians. No politician in the United States had to order the churches shut down. They agreed to it. It's voluntary. Right. So there was no First Amendment issue, really. There, subsequently, there are some other churches, like in California, sued some non-aligned Protestant churches. But from what I understand, Catholic American Catholic Church, the Episcopacy, just completely surrendered and didn't even question it. They accepted everything at face value. They, you know, again, for a better part of 6 weeks, church, you couldn't go to church, if I recall. And even in my own parish, you know, they still have a strict regimen, and it's caused me to more or less just leave the parish because I can't put up with some of their restrictions they have going to church. And this, it's spotty throughout the diocese. I found one church that was really, and only about maybe 15% of the churchgoers wear a mask at church, and most people don't. And you can tell that the priests there are very skeptical and not happy with the new normal in the Catholic Church. Although our bishop is very, I think is compromised, and like so many bishops, and so they've been a part of this apostasy that we witnessed, you know, with the closing of the churches.
Yeah, you really do have to wonder if they're. You don't want to speculate too much. But you really do have to wonder if not only is it a acquiescence on their part, but if there isn't some sort of deep-seated, almost perverse desire to wreck that which they are responsible for. I mean, mm-hmm. One hates to go there, and yet you... I mean, certainly the psychology of people with certain sexual disorders, of which there seem to be no small number in the Episcopacy, do have these kind of upside down modes of reasoning.
Yeah. Is this a function, you know, of the gay mafia within the Catholic Church that Cardinal Vigano speaks of? He was made aware of when he was the papal nuncio here dealing with McCarrick and his operation. And, of course, his successor is also suspected as such, and it wouldn't surprise me, in the Baltimore-Washington diocese. It's something. And bishops are, you know, brick-and-mortar men, and even from the brick-and-mortar interest, you wonder how is it that they are – able to shut down church operations, limit church capacity, shut down, you know, parish events, and still maintain these expensive operations. And I suspect there's probably money. I mean, there's so many billions and trillions of dollars that are being dispersed and spent and created out of thin air. And I suspect, much like a lot of the sports franchises were paid off to shut down their operations so they wouldn't protest, that perhaps there's been money put under the table to buy off the various churches in the Episcopacy to keep their operations going, because no one's really tracking the money anymore. There's no the billions and trillions that are spending in COVID relief. There's no hundreds of billions just going out, and there's no accountability for it. So there's probably a lot of black money, black budget going on here that's buying off these institutions to do the bidding, you know. That's why there's so much coordination or agreement throughout the country, through corporations and through these institutions, to go along with what is obvious now an operation. You know, it's not a real pandemic.
Right. They've followed a very odd business model for making a profit, and it does beg some questioning. You know, I always, and you probably have heard it too, I mean, when we interact with Protestant friends and neighbors, somewhere along the line, you're going to hear this thing about you Catholics, you know, you just do whatever the Pope says. And of course that is, I mean, where do you even begin to explain that it doesn't quite work that way? And their magisterial, operations that have to occur before things are pronounced ex cathedra. And there's really only been a few things like that. You know, but, Good Friday, I stopped in at my local parish for the Stations of the Cross. And it's interesting. I picked up, I think this is telling. I picked up two booklets in the back. They were different. It turns out they're written by the same fellow, some Clarence Ensler. One was back in the 1970s and another one, and then it was reprinted in the 90s. In the 70s, it had kind of interesting modernistic churchy photos. The one in the 90s, of course, resorted to those cartoonish, blocky pictures of our Lord and all the other figures surrounding him. You know, the ones where their hands are like three times the size of their head and stuff like that. And you know, they all look as though they have serious neurological problems, the way they're positioned and that sort of thing. Anyway, that aside, it's interesting. The books are all, they are identical in almost every way in the text, except for this. In the early one, in this first station, it says, my Jesus, Lord, obedience cost you your life. For me, it cost me an act of will, no more, and yet how hard it is for me to bend. Remove the blinders from my eyes, that I may see that it is you whom I obey in all who govern me. Lord, it is you. Now, in the 90s version, that phrase, in all who govern me, was removed, but, and this is what I love, somebody went through every copy and wrote it in by hand. So, in other words, the point I'm getting at is that there is something in the church where, and it comes, I guess, from Romans 13, or I think an exaggeration or misinterpretation of Romans 13. Maybe that's certainly disputable, but of seeing all civil authorities as well, as St. Paul says, wielding the sword, you know, for God. But I thought this was interesting, and I think it is also theologically disputable about seeing Jesus in all those who govern me. I'm wondering, like, when Jesus was before Pilate, did he see himself in Pilate? I guess, I mean, in some ways, I guess you could say something like that. But it leads to odd constructions, I think. But I bring this up because there, I'm trying to grasp in my own life, my own understanding as a Catholic and therefore also as a citizen of some nation, how really to think about this issue. And I've been talking about for a while the idea of there being something like a malignant obedience. And I mean, we know from the Catechism that the Church even recognizes that governments can become so corrupt that even revolution can be entertained if it's likely to succeed. I mean, I just put it on the table. I don't have any sort of pronouncement to render on that. But it does seem as though we could, as Catholic, mature Catholics, really ask questions about the distinction between servile obedience, obeisance, political dissent, and politics does seem to be the purview or the charism of the layman, and then how we put that together.
Well, there's a lot of inconsistency here within the church regarding obedience, or mm-hmm. disobedience or protest. A good example is late May and June, and throughout the summer, you had they call the Black Lives Matter protest in the wake of the George Floyd incident, where he died in police custody. And of course, now there's a trial that's involved regarding that case with Derek Chauvin. My local diocesan newspaper came out and was talking about racism and condemning racism. Mm-hmm. The Pope came out and said that, racism is as bad as abortion. And that's funny because I know what abortion is. I simply don't know what racism is. It keeps changing. There's no way you can really define it. But when it comes to things like protesting and defying lawful authorities of the state, even insurrection, that word, that popped up last January, is that the church is certainly willing to celebrate the civil rights movement.
Right.
Of the 1960s, and they'll tout Martin Luther King as a figure, despite his well-known flaws, as sort of a figure we should admire and emulate.
Or the flaunting of immigration law.
Or immigration laws, or the sanctuary movements, and these things are all violating state and federal law. But these are matters of conscience, and you're allowed to protest in the streets and. Sit down protest and these things and invite the police to come in and arrest you, serve time in prison, letters from a Birmingham jail or famous letters that Martin Luther King supposedly wrote, although some people think it was ghostwritten for him. David Horowitz, I think, is suspected as the real author of that. But where it's praised as a noble thing to oppose immoral laws, but something like if someone were to – but nowhere did the church come out and give any support to people protesting lockdowns of churches, and not just businesses but churches. And so, again, it seems to be a double standard. But that's not too surprising because something like the Civil Rights Movement, which the power structure approved of, they were obviously that type of in the streets protesting was going to receive very positive – press coverage and a very positive narrative has been spun to sort of burn that in the public consciousness of Americans about the moral rectitude and righteousness of the civil rights movement. It was good versus bad, black versus white, roughly. There was no nuance or complexity to that at all. Of course, the civil rights movement itself was sort of used as a cudgel or a tool, leveraged to break up ethnic Catholic neighborhoods in the 1960s and destroy a lot of the church's political power and cultural power in the process under the guise of integration. And so this is somewhere where the church is either woefully naive about, say, covert warfare, covert psychological warfare, and isn't really equipped to deal or doesn't have the tools, the weapons or even the proper outlook to deal with their adversaries. And so when you have the spectacle of, say, a Jewish governor of Illinois or a Jewish governor of Pennsylvania closing Catholic churches, you would think there'd be some – this is the point where sort of traditional ethnic suspicion and ethnic solidarity would work politically to fight these things. But ethnic whites have been denied that, and the church played a part of that in the 1960s because of the civil rights narrative, have been denied those identities to fight back. And so now all the, you know, the ethnic whites are now just one big white America, homogeneous white America that has no identity, nor if they exercise that identity, it's not considered legitimate. It's, you know, white supremacy, as they say. So all these factors come into play in something like the COVID-19 operation. Because there are no longer any communities with the resolve or the identity to fight back, against, you know, the state authorities. And you have you do have this sort of supine, position of the Catholic leadership, the Catholic hierarchy, which just accepts at face value the assertions mm-hmm. of government officials and their scientific lackeys. Yeah. Who ultimately work for oligarchs, you know, mm-hmm. But then again, you have the Catholic Church signing on with, what was it called, with this Davos said about inclusive capitalism and the Pope talking about, concerns of climate change. And of course that feeds into Agenda 2030 and Agenda 21, which is ultimately a genocidal program. So the Church, although it's still holding to its traditional teachings of things like abortion, euthanasia, are in effect supporting policies and programs which ultimately lead to the very thing that the Church doctrine condemns, which is the culture of death.
And not only has the Church almost prided itself on its ability to circumvent the reason of established laws with their own kind of hand-wringing, grinning, Machiavellian indulgence in power politics and backroom dealing. Not only has it done that vis-a-vis these outside forces, even within the Church, they've undermined their own teaching. On the one hand, there is teaching on the book about contraception, and yet this seems really only to apply or the encouragement to have children only really seems to apply to non-whites. Whites are sort of permitted, if not encouraged, to engage in contraception. I remember when Pope John Paul II took a trip to the Northern Hemisphere and was visiting was about to visit the Canadians, and there were all these preliminary things, and the Canadian bishops had somehow gathered together in some kind of powwow and sent him their concerns about the Church teaching on contraception. And his response, I remember I was somewhat devastated just by the inconsistency of it. He said, well, I have to teach the way I must teach, and you must teach the way you must teach. Well, I mean, if that doesn't undermine the whole sense of the uniformity of truth or the Church teaching on some matter, I don't know what does.
Yeah, and he's basically they're encouraging sort of his vaguely anti-natalist, mm-hmm. which is a pro-death approach to the native white population, Canadians. At the same time, the Church is accepting this whole idea of unrestricted immigration into countries from non-white countries, from the third world, you know. And so you have the browning or the yellowing of these societies, where Canada, they've had a huge Chinese influx of these things. And, they're saying, well, this is necessary because there's a population, demographics, people having smaller families, you have to import labor. Well, that wouldn't be the case if people were having larger families.
That's right.
At the same time, you can't say there's a overpopulation problem at the same time, you know, draining resources and inviting unrestricted immigration from the third world. What you're really seeing here is, is the bishops and the church sort of embracing that idea. I don't know how conscious it is, but what the difference is, if you have a native population with high birth rates, they're going to have cohesive, homogeneous communities. They're going to organize. They're going to have things like labor unions. And they're going to be able to, they'll have certain expectations of wages, pay high wages and these things. And the way you get around that is you import cheap labor.
Yes.
And that's what something historically has always been a problem is the crux of the immigration issue isn't racial. It's the ability for a country to maintain its cultural integrity, and it's a political integrity, it's sovereignty. You can't do that in the face of waves of mass immigration. And the way you maintain a culture and a strong society is you maintain a balance or a condition where the working class, which is always going to be the bulk of the pot, at least it should be, because work needs to be done, and everyone should or can go to college and get a technical degree or advanced academic degree. There's work that needs to be done, and you maintain high wages for them. They can have larger families. They've undermined that with immigration. And that's something this goes way back to. I mean, even Egyptian society destroyed itself with slave labor, and that's something that can never be resolved. Like the United States, because you had a few who wanted cheap labor, they brought slaves into the country. The beneficiaries of that were the slave owners, the big large slave owners, many of whom were Jewish, by the way, the traders. Mm-hmm. But the people that were hurt by that were the working class, whites, whose wages were kept low. At the same time, we created what is clearly now an intractable race problem, made intractable by other interests. Again, you have the divide and conquer strategy. It's always a good issue to have to aggravate those problems. That's what the media is for. New York Times is all about, and 1619 Project is all about. But you can't. If you're constantly bringing in, other races or ethnic groups from other countries, you're going to create sort of a what they call a Tower of Babel situation, where no one will be able to organize, and that's what they want. And that way you can, that's why not even Tucker Carlson got into trouble recently for even broaching the topic of replacement immigration. And,
It was wonderful.
But he didn't mention race. Obviously he's dog whistling it, but the other people saw race. People like, the ADL, groups like the ADL see it as a racial issue. Southern Poverty Law Center see it as a race issue.
Yeah.
And they see the fact that the decline of the, of Heritage America or the white majority, they see it as a good thing. So they're focused on it. But if someone notices that they're working to, replace the white population, that's racism. That's white nationalism, although they're dedicated to it, and see it as a good
thing. Tucker seemed to cast what I listened to tonight. He seemed to cast it in turn, and it's good. It's a good argument. It's partial, I think, though. He cast it in terms of being disenfranchised. In other words, the native or the traditional Americans being disenfranchised of their vote by dilution. With demographic replacement, and I see that certainly as existing in it, but I also see it as also being reproductively neutered by demographic replacement.
Well, yeah, that's one thing. Is that there's different levels to this. One thing is, you dilute the host population by flooding it with mass immigration. At the same time. Not maintaining any standards with elections. We saw that last November, but you're creating sort of these jokes of election where people no longer even have to present IDs. They're trying to pass that law where you have election fraud. And so even the integrity of the elections are no longer, most people don't, even see our elections as having any integrity. But, you have, at the same time, the overall culture, This also creates economic conditions where people can't support families, can't have families, can't buy a house. Obviously, the taxes and inflation the debt don't help. At the same time, you have a sort of a broader culture that's being created, which doesn't lend itself to family formation.
Right.
That's sort of the degeneracy, and it literally is degenerate because people aren't being procreative anymore. And that culture has become almost cartoonishly perverse now. You know,
when I arrived at Notre Dame in the early 80s, I was circulating around an idea. I called it condom economics. Brian McCall and I plan on doing a piece on Catholic Family News. Of course, I'm going to change it to contraceptive economics, for the sensibilities of his audience. But this is my show, so I'm going to call it what I called it in the, my goal was to be intentionally provocative. I mean, because Notre Dame was sort of the location where the Catholic Church in general, worldwide, but certainly in the United States, had where it was the campus upon, literally the campus in the original sense of battlefield, the campus upon which this whole issue of contraception was playing out in a giant drama. Most of the professors there in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, for them it was a foregone conclusion that with the Vatican II and just the general opening up of the church, that of course we were going to throw the whole contraception thing into the trash bin. And then when Pope Paul, who is, I mean, undeniably pretty much a liberal anyway, but when he issued his opinion in Humanae Vitae, it created a shattering effect that we're still living in the wake of that today. Even Protestants in the general society are living in the wake of that, although they don't know it by any terminology. I was circulating around this idea of condom economics and the effect on the economy of people making a choice to remain in a state of perpetual adolescence. For most people, becoming a parent is what causes them to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, those who are maybe called to the celibate life and stuff, that occurs in other ways. And it's not that it can't occur for a single person, but they pretty much have to be. The process is always the same, and that is the human developmental process has to go from selfish infant to, which is perfect since, I mean, that infants need to be selfish to get the needs met, to gradually becoming socialized, devoted to either another person or the church, being pulled out of yourself further with responsibility either for children or a flock, and then eventually extending beyond your own family to larger groupings like neighborhood and nation. So the contraception, I don't want to steal our fire from Brian in my future talk, but the point is that the contraception just absolutely corrupts that, and it's diabolical on the level of natural selection. I'm a biologist, by the way, for the audience's information. So I do see things in terms of selective processes too. And so not only does it have personal disaster consequence, it has biologic disasters consequence. It has economic disasters and political. I mean, it undermines the nation in the ways that you're describing here.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is with the issue of contraception and the Catholic Church. Of course, this became a big issue because in the early 60s, the so-called pill was rolled
yes.
out, and this became something that within the means of most people, they could just get their local pharmacy. And also, you had the big. There were laws against it, certain so-called blue laws throughout the states that, more, for the most part, weren't really enforced. And so there's the 1965 case where the Connecticut law, I believe, was overturned.
Right.
And the right to privacy was invoked to overturn the state of Connecticut's law against contraception. And then at that point, the government, and now that was law was brought not so much to establish the right to a private individual to go purchase contraceptives. It was there to overturn the law so the government could get in the business of promoting it. And of course, then if it is indeed a private matter, what business does the government have in promoting it? So they were contradicting
right.
themselves.
I never thought of that. That's beautiful.
I think it was Thomas Ball, the Catholic lawyer in Pennsylvania, who pointed that out.
And by the way, that law in Connecticut and wherever else it was found before that, it people think, oh, that was those darn Catholics, you know. No, it wasn't. It was
no.
the Protestants who were trying to control the Catholic population.
Yeah, I know.
Who were saying that you can't buy contraceptives.
Yeah. Not a very Catholic state, Connecticut. Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965. Of course, that's the foundation for 8 years later in Roe v. Wade, another right to abortion. Again, part of which was the so-called right to privacy found in the penumbras and emanations of the 14th Amendment, whatever, that the Supreme Court created. But the expectation of it, you know, there was this is the function of the lay theologians, people like Michael Novak, I think, was a big advocate of this at the time. I think he'd since recanted. But the expectation that the church would overturn its traditional teachings so it could modernize. This also coincides with the Second Vatican Council, 1962 to 1965, when it was sort of spun in the media as the church was modernizing itself to make itself relevant to the modern world. And there was an operation conducted by the CIA, Time Life, Henry Luce's media empire, to control the interpretation, not only try to control the documents that came out of the council, but also, it's more importantly, perhaps, the how it was interpreted. And, of course, how it was interpreted in the media was going to determine how most people thought what the Vatican Council was all about. And you had people within the church, traitors within the church, like Theodore Hesburgh of Notre Dame, who I think had 1966 or 67 had the Land O'Lakes conference on contraception, sort of anticipating Humanae Vitae, what they thought that would come out would be promulgated or at least clarified in Humanae Vitae. But you had also sort of the bishops lost their nerve because they lost control. One thing is Hesburgh turned Notre Dame over to lay authority in the name of academic freedom, although what he really was doing was turning it over to the Rockefellers. He would later become a board member and a chairman of the Rockefeller
Foundation. I have a little insight into that. When I was at Notre Dame, I think this is the first time I've ever told this story publicly. One Friday night, I left the cafeteria and just tired after working hard, and I went to the library, which of course was empty, and I just strolled through the magazine, so periodical section. I just grabbed something, And it was one of these, I don't know if it was Look or Life or something, one of these photo magazines. And I kind of plopped down in one of the chairs. And I look, and who's on the front of it but Nelson Rockefeller? And it says Nelson, something like, I've been trying to find this. I hope maybe somebody who's listening to this can find this. I've been looking for it. Shouldn't be too hard. But it's like Nelson Rockefeller, evangelist of the gospel. I was like, what? What? And I read this, and it's, yeah, he's going with a bunch of Baptist ministers to South America to spread the gospel. Really? And then I see buried in the article, it says, that he's also going to be promoting the use of contraception. And, you know, all of a sudden it all fit together for me. Theodore Hesburgh, Notre Dame's explosion of building and development. I always thought it was interesting that Hesburgh was on the board of Chase Manhattan Bank.
Yes. And another Rockefeller Foundation and Chase Manhattan.
Does it? I mean, when I think of bankers, I don't necessarily think of Theodore Hesburgh, but I guess he brought that moral dimension.
yes. What happened was the Notre Dame really wanted all that money from the foundation money. It had been revealed in the 1950s in the Rees Committee hearings that the foundation money had been deprived or denied to Catholic institutions, and so there was a time when Catholic schools had a distinct identity to them. But the that's the whole purpose of Notre Dame was to build a unique Catholic university. There are plenty of other universities that are gobbling up Rockefeller money and government money, state institutions. So they wanted, and they got Hesburgh to sort of sell out and accept all that money. And that's why you had this explosion of building. And this is why to this day, Notre Dame has, I don't know, has like a $30 billion endowment and still charges $60,000 a year to go to Catholics to go to school there.
So it gets a little more kind of this anecdotal color story gets a little more interesting.
Yeah.
And that is, so I, as a doctoral candidate in biology, I'm required to teach laboratories. Okay. So, and we would have weekly meetings with the professor who organized that, a woman named Linda Margaret Hunt, fine lady. And we would prepare for the upcoming laboratory that week. And, you know, all these textbooks, these biology textbooks, would have in this, like in the center of them, they would devote several pages to contraception and contraceptive techniques and how to use contraception. And really, you know, as a biologist, I'd say, well, that doesn't really seem to, you know, it has some kind of little tangential connection to biology. But, it's clearly a it's an insert. It's an advertising insert.
And it's anti-biological.
Yes, and it's anti-biological.
Yeah.
So I remember one of these preparatory meetings, you know, I raised my hand. I said, you know, Dr. Hunt, I said, I'll be happy to cover these topics about contraception as long as I can add my comments as a Catholic, you know. Mind you, this is Catholic Notre Dame, right?
Yes. So.
It's kind of the same experience that E. Michael Jones had across the street at St. Mary's.
Yeah, being polite in a Catholic school.
So I said, as long as I could add this, you know, my little spin at the end, I'll do this. I'll cover the topics as information, you know. And, you know, she was fine with that. And she said, let me tell you a little story. So she tells the whole group this. She says, years ago, Father Hesburgh, in his clerical garb, would come in to my biology class, and he would teach one class in biology. The whole class would be devoted to how to use contraceptive devices. Did you hear what I just said?
Yeah, why would he be so, enthusiastic about it? Yeah.
The president of the university, a priest, would come in and teach them how to use contraception. I mean, it's scandalizing, really. But I think the whole thing fits together perfectly. And I had another little experience. We won't go into it now. Maybe if we do another show, I hope we do. I'll go into another little Rockefeller expose that I came across last month while I was traveling in the Caribbean. But anyway, so yes, I mean, it's pretty clear for anyone who has eyes to see that there is, in fact, always a story behind the story, and that something that Joe Atwell and I have been talking about is that vigilance in looking for these hidden stories is really, I mean, this is not pathology. This is not, I mean, what the CIA called conspiracy theory, but rather this is normal biology, and all you have to do to confirm it is in the early morning, now that it's spring, go out in your yard and watch the robins, and there will be one robin who is devoting full attention to looking around for predators. Because the world is full of predators, and as Catholics, we believe there is a supreme predator, right? A spiritual
yes.
predator.
Yeah.
So that is, I think that's how that whole story of the corruption of the American Catholic Church came together for me.
Yeah, the going back to the whole pushing of contraceptives, their promotion, evidently even within Catholic institutions, shows that they had been infiltrated prior to the 1960s. But mm-hmm. It sets society off on a trajectory which is unsustainable. And one of the things is obviously the idea of contraception is that the Catholic Church teachings that. Is that it violates the unitive and procreative elements of human sexuality in order to be true to that. You have to both be respectful for the unitive and procreative, meaning as an act of love between a man and a wife, and also it has the potential for the creation of new life. And of course, this creates a sustainable situation, because if a man and woman love each other, they can provide a home for the child that comes from their union. And there is at least there's a support system for the children that come from this. And if everyone does this, you have a society which isn't without problems, but society has the capacity to deal with whatever problems it does have, and also is growth, and it's stable, and it's peaceful. And of course, as marriage rates decline, as illegitimacy rates increase, you have a higher crime, higher poverty, more psychological problems, sexual dysfunctions, sexual confusion, these things, which they know this because they know if they break that cycle, this is something that the American Jewish Committee looked into doing with their authority and personalities. You weaken the family, weaken the father figure, and promote sexual degeneracy. You can weaken the family, at least from their perspective, is decrease the chances or the risk of fascism, and get into that whole pathological way of looking at things. Under the contraceptive regime, you also have certain patterns of living change. One thing is that no longer the roles between men and women become more confused. If the woman is infertile because of her medicated womb or the drug she's taking, she's going to go out and work, and all of a sudden the spending and consuming habits are going to change. And all of a sudden people are going to be making more money. They're going to spend more money. Prices are going to go up for demand and these things. They're not going to be spending money on things that are procreative and like children. They're going to spend money, more money on consumer items and stuff. Of course, that's going to affect their relationships. They're going to have higher divorce rates, especially if the woman is working more, because she's going to be exposed in the workforce, and there's going to be greater temptation for these things. And this is why we have such a high divorce rate. At the same time, you have, again, you don't have the support system for families anymore, or the presumption that a couple is going to produce a sizable family. The whole idea about sex becomes about, becomes a sort of a selfish entertainment and becomes sort of recreational. And then, of course, then if you buy into the whole contraceptive regime, you have no principled argument against sexual perversions like homosexuality if it is indeed about pleasure. Then it's just an aesthetic thing. It's like a yuck factor. But there's no principled argument against homosexuality if you accept homosexuality. Because all that is just a further degenerative violation of the natural law.
Let me throw in another anecdotal bit of color here. I was teaching biology in California at a variety of places. One of them was a Catholic school called Notre Dame in Belmont. And a girls' school. Well, but they had let in some males, you know, but it had principally been a girls' school. And they would invite, in his later retirement years, a scientist from down in Palo Alto, who worked at a company called Syntex. That was the producer of the first oral contraceptive pill. And his name was Carl DeJossi. And Carl DeJossi was a chemist who designed this first contraceptive pill. I think, as I recall it, he used yams or something to extract a steroid from it that they made the pill out of. Now, so in his later years, he would do poetry reading. And so he would come and he would do these poetry readings at this Catholic, essentially still a Catholic girls' school, you know. But this Catholic college would have this kind of little bit of what would you call it? Kind of festival, I guess, of I think it lasted more than one day, where they brought in Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood would teach the girls not only about contraception and how to procure abortions and stuff, they would also have sex toys. And so, you know, as you're a Catholic parent, you know how that must just warm the heart, I would think, of a traditional Catholic parent to know that they're sending their daughter there. But I assume that, you know, most of the parents in the Bay Area who sent their children there had full knowledge of what they were getting. And I remember one evening, this college had, as an invited speaker, Gloria Steinem, you know, CIA.
Yeah.
Operative Gloria Steinem to come in and give a talk. And I remember, Tim, that the line into the college went out to the highway. This place was packed. People standing outside. Somehow, fortunately, I managed to get inside. And, you know, at that time, Promise Keepers was kind of a big thing. It was an attempt among the Protestants, I guess, to kickstart and bootstrap a kind of revival among men. It was somewhat successful, actually.
Yeah, I remember.
And I remember one gal. She was, in fact, I think, in my class. I remember her standing up during the Q&A and saying, she said, she brought up the topic of Promise Keepers and what a threat it was going to be to women in America. And I remember Gloria Steinem saying to her, I'll tell you what, when we have our meeting after this convocation, the meeting of a small group, I'm going to give you some ideas about how to deal with promise keepers. And I remember, I don't know that it's connected, but I do remember after that hearing on the radio discussions about how the goal was to find a kind of promise keeper man and seduce him into sex, you know, as a way of undermining that whole movement and revealing the hypocrisy of it. Mm-hmm. That's in the late 90s, and so there you go. There's Catholic education, not 30 years after the main event.
Yeah, a lot of these things, these operations, are there to they'll target a girls' institution like that, a girls' school, and the idea is sort of break down the national inhibition that many of the girls will have. And you do that in a mass setting. And that's, you know, that's what the, you know, like rock festivals are all about, a mass setting where you break down inhibitions. That's what college is largely about now. That's why at Notre Dame, when they hosted the vagina monologues, is there to introduce sort of this crudeness into it. So you lose your inhibition, these things. And it's
immediately reinforced by peer pressure.
Yes. And Gloria Steinem is a celebrity. She's created by the power structure, the male power structure. she wasn't self-made. She was I think came from a broken family, and she was courted. I think she was recipient of a scholarship she got that only existed for her. It was a CIA, cover for a CIA, because she was part of the culture Congress of Cultural Freedom, and she was recruited, by the CIA back in the late 50s or early 60s, late 50s, out of high school. I think she came from Ohio or something.
And, well, when when there's a talent there, it needs to be reaped soon.
Yes, yeah. and so she was she went on a strange scholarship, but then she said we go to Europe, and her job in Europe was a report to the CIA on radical students. The report on them. So she this was exposed in as early as the 1960s. I think in Ramparts magazine or something.
To report on them and recruit them.
Recruit them, because it's all about controlled opposition. Yeah. And then you get a bunch of college students just spouting, rhetoric.
Nonsense.
Thinking that they're going against the system when they're being brainwashed by the system.
They exploit that period of life where we are developing our powers of critique, of separating ourselves from a narrative matrix and questioning received wisdoms. And there probably is a developmental necessity to some of that. Speaking as somebody who tried to teach college, and it's like they say of horses. You want a horse to have something they call try. A horse that doesn't have try, you're not going to be able to prune down its behaviors, because it doesn't really have much behavior, So you do want some of that activity, but then the academy has been wholly marched through in Gramscian fashion, and replaced with these Marxists. It's a total disaster. You know, I just read also before. See, by the way, you can see when I schedule all my preparation. Just before we were talking tonight, I was reading a Crisis Magazine art piece by Alila Lawler and Alila Miller. And it's really quite good. It's Catholic Men Rise Up and Fight. This is April 7th issue. Once again, it's women who have to, I think, be the ones who stand out and, like St. Birgitta challenging the Avignon Pope, they have to be the ones who say, come on, guys, you can be strong. We need you to be strong. Because men in our society, we have been robbed of our ability to speak out forcefully. I mean, even if we speak firmly, we have the women surrounding us in the offices dialing 911.
Mm-hmm.
If you do get a chance to look at that, I think it's great. Just a few lines out of it, maybe if you can indulge us a little bit. They start off with talking about the COVID and the restrictions that that the bishops have weakly permitted to happen. It says those not succumbing to this new normal are shamed as selfish and uncharitable for daring to question the unprecedented suspension of worship and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on to say, the faithful, this is what I like about it, is because they're really speaking, I think, from the heart, and they're starting to use a language that we males are not permitted to use. They say the faithful who want to worship as God commands are weary. Most troubling of all is the strangely naive and imprudent cooperation with the state to pressure or require the faithful to accept the COVID-19 jab. And then next paragraph is simply one sentence. We have had it. And I think what's beautiful about that is such a simple sentence, but really it is authoritative, and it also has just a little bit of spice of threat to it.
Yes, yes. It's what they have to feel, yes.
Yes, and you know, when I was in the Caribbean, Joe and I recorded a piece, you know, my experiences at the Catholic Church down there. And as I put it there, I said, you know, Joe, if I were the bishop, I like to imagine that, you know, I had been the bishop, and I think I would imagine myself as saying, because, for instance, people would say to me, I would go up to communion, you know, without a mask, and I'd just get the communion on the tongue, you know. And guess what? They gave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't complicated. And I had a good chat with the priest afterward. But if I were the bishop, and so people would say, I'm sorry, I'm getting jumbled here. People would say to me, oh, but you know, the authorities, they'll shut down the church, or they'll do all kind of horrible things. And I said, you know, if I were the bishop, I would say to the authorities, go ahead, do it. You go ahead. And you close down those churches. You do what they did in Canada with the fences around the church, right? I would say, go ahead, do it. Or if you want to come into the church and you want to start dragging out my parishioners, I can't stop you, can I? I can try and stand in the door, and I'll try and stand in the door. But I can't, you know, you're right. I can't, I don't have guns. But you go ahead and do it. You lock up the doors. And you know what? I'll ask my parishioners to stand in the street and pray outside the street. I mean, the church is just as good as a big tabernacle as it is as a small one on top of the altar. So that's what we'll do. You close us on Easter Sunday, and I'll tell you what, we'll stand outside. And in fact, the parishioners can do this on their own. They can gather in the streets and say rosaries and march up and down the streets. Why not? That's the kind of spirit we need. And I think that's a little bit of the flavor I get from what these two women are writing.
Yeah. And we've had it, and just the hint of a threat. And unfortunately, that's what, some of these, public officials, the public health bureaucrats need to feel, because they think they're impervious. There's no threat. But when you violate people's civil rights and you violate their constitutional rights, the right to practice religion, you should feel some consequences for your actions, which are wholly illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's an act of treason, you know.
Yeah,
what these governors have done, you know, what these governors have done.
When you listen to something like these public radio shows, you know, they like talking about tipping points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tipping. Well, how about this tipping point? How about this tipping point where all of a sudden, and I'm not advocating anything whatsoever. I mean, I want to keep all of my red stuff on the inside. Mm-hmm. And I hope everybody else does, too. But, you know, at some point, anyone like you who has read much more history than me knows that sometimes you push this stuff, and especially when, as an authority, you don't permit people to speak. What that means is the people are going to say, okay, I won't speak, but that doesn't mean that the forces aren't building. And at some point, you know, it just does happen that authorities, civil authorities, even bishops, you know, find themselves in a interesting dilemma.
Well, I just find at this point, more than a year into it, that people in those positions aren't looking around and seeing for what it is, and then aren't acting accordingly. My diocesan newspaper is still carrying on as if there's a pandemic out there.
Yeah. You know,
they have students wearing masks in schools. The school my son attends, they only have like half week. Other days they don't allow the full, students in. So everyone has to, you have remote learning half the week and regular learning the second part of the week or first part of the week. And it's almost like telling them, do you want to be a school or not? If you don't want to be a school, shut down and we'll use the property to build another housing development on it, you know.
And by the way, you know, just to tie this back to our conversation about having larger families, people they don't think properly. They get the cart before the horse. You see, you have large families and then you develop schools.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, I don't know. Once we get a new couch and once we find a neighborhood that has a nice school, and then once we, once we achieve this level of income and no, you have the families. My rule of thumb, because I was challenged once by a group of parishioners we were meeting at somebody's home, and the women challenged me. So how many children are you supposed to have? And I don't know. I was just thinking quickly on the spot, and I said, well, how about like the Holy Family? They had one more than could be expected. Right? Always one more than could be expected. You know, just try it. I don't see how it works. And then you create the economic gradient where people start saying, holy mackerel, we got to educate these little buggers.
Yeah.
Then you have roles for teachers. You have people who have to make, baby carriages and you start investing in real materials, not just an economy based on ones and zeros,
yeah,
and electrons, but on atoms.
The that's another thing is there was a time the reason for the success of the Catholic school system is that you had a support system for through the parish system, and large families not only they could pool the resources and provide a private Catholic school for the children in the neighborhood in the parish with everyone pooling their resources, and also from those large families there would always be holy orders, a few nuns and priests, and of course then they'd pay for their education, and the nuns and priests would teach at the school,
so
this parish structure would support the school system, and you had the vocations, and so you had a portion of those people going into holy orders would become teachers. And
it was an economy of grace.
It was it was almost like something that maybe existed in pre-Reformation England. With the common fields and these things, and so, but what happened was when the parishes were broken up in some of these areas, and it went into suburbia. It didn't have the concentration that it once was. You lacked the identity. At the same time, people started having less children. Vocations dropped, and you didn't have enough priests and nuns to teach. So you started having to hire lay people to teach and pay them higher salaries.
Right.
And also a lot of times there's a lot of the people, at least when I was in Catholic school in the 70s, some of the women teaching, they were older women who had raised their kids and they were supported by their husbands.
Yes.
And so they were being paid what really amounted to was a stipend to teach.
Right.
You know, now you have a lot of these Catholic institutions who are trying to pay competitive salaries with the public school systems, and you can't do that. Or you can't do it in a way to have tuitions that are affordable for larger families. So now you have exorbitant tuition to go to a Catholic school. And it used to be that Catholic schools were affordable for working class families. And that's the complete, the economy was destroyed. And one thing I was reading, a book by E. Michael Jones. He talked about how this wasn't just, something that happened. It was intentional, is the, destruction of,
slaughter of cities.
Yeah, the slaughter of cities was with the cities, but he talks what happened out what order it was in California, where they instituted Carl Rogers' self-help therapy to break up the holy order, and the holy order itself, the order of nuns, was the backbone of the Catholic school system. Those were the ones who provided the teachers. So when that collapsed, the school system wasn't able to have as many teachers. And it's contributed to the decline of the school system there.
Yeah.
You know,
Tim, there is a type of education that you get. For instance, I absolutely love, and I argue that it's perfectly fitting for a biologist. I absolutely love Aristotelian philosophy. I mean, of course, Aristotle was an excellent biologist. I mean, for all the, mistakes, if you could call it. I mean, he made incredible observations for somebody at that time. And building on that was, of course, Thomas Aquinas in around 1300. This type of learning and letters and the classics in general, this is incredibly valuable for training the mind. And you just can't do that very well in a non-Catholic setting. Partly, I'm not sure why, I'm just speculating here. It's just that in the non-Catholic setting, there's such a pressure on pragmatism, on something being immediately apparent as useful. You know, why can't we teach them nursing technology, or why can't we teach them electronic or computers or something? That's what they really need. You know, they don't need to be learning about angels on a pin or anything. All that old trope. But you see, now we're seeing the fruit of a society where scientists, and fortunately I've gotten to meet some of the world's best scientists when I was working in Stockholm. In fact, we had the 100th anniversary of the Nobel Prize while I was there. I mean, just, and, you know, oddly enough, the one guy I remember was Carrie Mullis. But, I guess that was maybe providential. But anyway, so we're seeing the fruits of very intelligent, very skillful, really scientific and technological thinking, but it's devoid of a proper foundation in, I would say, Aristotelian and Thomistic philosophy, which by the way, just works wonderfully for both biology and information theory. I had a great conversation with a philosopher who, when he really sat down and thought about it, we agreed that Aristotle and Aquinas would feel very comfortable with Shannon Weaver's information theory and the mathematical theory of communication, that they would have understood what we were talking about. But you see, because these modern information theorists, Norbert Wiener, what have you, because they, I say they lacked the proper grounding in Catholic philosophy, they ran off the rails.
They're just sort of reductionist materialist, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And you see that with someone as, you know, I wouldn't even consider him intellectual, but someone like a Bill Gates who just has a fetish for technology, but really when it comes with something like philosophy or bigger questions, he's a dullard.
And we even have to ask whether he's nothing but, you know, kind of an empty front man and always has been. Like all these guys, Zuckerberg.
Well, his family roots, Gates and all that. You know, he ties back to the Rockefellers. All these people, you know, even like Steinem, these were just put up here. Marketing, he's almost like a Chef Boyardee or something, or a Betty Crocker figure, you know.
But not Aunt Jemima.
No, not that. I was going to say Alfred E. Newman, but you're right about that, because the revival, at least the heyday of Catholic education in America, coincided sort of with the age of Thomism, which was revitalized in the Catholic Church in the 19th century in response to the challenges of, you know, the French Revolution and Napoleon and the upheavals that was occurring in the 19th century in Europe. And of course, then Thomism was killed by people like Hesburgh in the 1960s at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And so now we have, again, we have this sort of this, this emptiness, this void, if you will, in these things. And so this is where you get something like, these Luciferian, you know, transhumanists, you know.
Yeah. Hey, you know, now that we're sort of getting near the end of, our evening together, you know, there's another interesting story about how the Academy has been destroyed. Back in 2013, a friend of mine was tapped to put on a philosophy conference. And I won't go into details, you know, just to protect him. He put on a philosophy conference. And he kindly asked me to be one of the speakers, and I did. And I talked on the mind-brain problem and quantum mechanics. So my background, Tim, is neurobiology. And I also then wanted to think about, well, so how do you solve what the mind-brain philosophers call the hard problem? And while in Stockholm, I was stimulated by a two-year-long seminar series on consciousness, the hard problem. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm participating in this, and it turns out at this conference, my friend had invited as the keynote speaker E. Michael Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And E. Michael Jones had just written his book, I think, Barren Metal. And but he was going to talk, basically on banking or something like this, you know. I'm not hearing from my friend for a couple weeks. And finally, I get in touch with him. He said, "Yeah, I didn't want to talk to you because I knew what you were going to say." He said, "Here's what happened. Apparently, some Jewish groups learned that E. Michael Jones was slated to talk, and they put pressure on the hosting university." Now, the university really has nothing to do with the conference other than hosting it, right? Mm-hmm. But you see how this game is played. It's not played through the rules of Hoyle for poetry. It's always this circumventing behind the scenes pressure lobbying stuff. And my friend said, "Yeah, the university got intense pressure, and of course I got intense pressure, and so I had to disinvite E. Michael Jones." And you see, I was angry. I'm not angry at my friend, but I do wish that I would have thought that it was an opportunity, you know, to go to the mat on this one and make it a national issue.
Instead of just collapse, break down, give in. I mean, that's something that's they've been doing for a long time, dynamic silence, where they go pressure behind the scenes. They can, use whatever financial leverage they have, or the fact that, you know, they'll have control of the media, and so they can exert these pressures. Jewish groups, Jewish organizations,
yes.
Southern Poverty Law Center, ADL. Michael Jones had a similar experience where just after he published the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, I think it was the Catholic University of America was going to sponsor a series of lectures on the topic. And it was all set up, and Jewish pressure was brought to bear against Catholic University to cancel lecture series. Now, why are Jews allowed to veto these things in Catholic institutions? And this is something that the Catholic Church cannot deal with now, but since the 1960s in Nostra Aetate.
Right.
And this dialogue, so-called dialogue with the Jews, where the Church has taken a completely
supine position in this dialogue.
And it puts a position of guilt, as if the Jews are in a position to lecture the Catholic Church. The Jews of all people, of all groupings, have seized a high moral ground and wagged their finger at the Catholic Church against these things. Of course, a lot of this has to do with their control of historical narratives and their dominance or their overwhelming control of the media and probably even finances as well. But this is something, this ironic position the Church has taken vis-a-vis the Jews since the 1960s, and what it does, it hobbles or neuters the Catholic Church in its ability to wage the culture war, which is perhaps, you could argue, its most important mission on this earth is fighting the moral corruption of society so that it can save souls. And if you can't fight that battle, you're not going to be able to save souls, which of course is her primary mission. And the inability to engage Jews and debate Jews on these matters is because of this, again, the supine position they've taken. And if you can't, if you're trying to address issues like moral issues like abortion, euthanasia, pornography, sex addiction, and sort of this degeneracy, you're going to have to wage war against those agents that are promoting it. And of course, Jewish organizations are a primary agent in promoting such things. And so if you are afraid to deal with the Jews, you won't be able to fight those culture wars, or at least have a chance of winning them.
Right. And it's a work of absolute mastery that not only are we as Catholics neutered in our ability to discuss this, but then the whole thing is folded up so you can't even talk about the fact that neutering went on. All of that becomes invisible.
There's a whole history there. There's a whole covert or sub rosa history of these things, which no one knows about. No, it's not taught about. You know, it's not taught about in the standard narrative of the civil rights era. The Catholic Church doesn't even, most Catholics aren't even aware of it. I think it was E. Michael Jones.
Yeah.
He was talking, I think it was at Xavier University. And I think he was discussing his research regarding the slaughter of cities. And he brought up Louis Wirth and what they were doing with urban renewal and how they were using the blacks to chase the ethnic Catholic whites out. And I think there's a history professor, Xavier, who said that this can't be true. If this were true, someone would have told me. He said, this can't be true. Someone important would have told me. And he said, Michael Jones says, I guess I'm not important.
Yeah.
If it's not being reported by Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather, it's not happening, right? You know?
Right.
This is the problem most people have is that this history, although as fascinating as it is, it's much more interesting than the standard narrative we're given. The moralistic fairy tales, good versus bad, it's far more nuanced, morally ambiguous, far more interesting than what we're presented. But
absolutely.
Nevertheless, it's not talked about.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the thing, here's what's interesting. And I had this conversation with Kevin McDonald, and that conversation needs to get posted here when I get busy here. I've had this discussion with him for a while, and in my case, I grew up Philo-Semitic.
I think that's the default position.
Yeah, and there were some reasons why, and I think sometime we're going to have to maybe have a discussion, because that's interesting in and of itself, the stories and how that, in my case, how the awakening occurred, and I'd like to hear how the awakening occurred in your case and other people's case.
The U.S. government, the State Department has an office dedicated to fighting international anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah. And
on.
Donald Trump has not been a particularly good ally.
Nor did it define anti-Semitism. I think they should open up an office to combat philo-Semitism. You know, across the hallway there.
Yeah.
Come to a happy medium, I guess you could say. But it's and they don't even define anti-Semitism. There was a thing recently, the governor of Texas, Abbott, came out, and he was flanked by two Jewish legislators, and he came out to condemn Gab, the alternative platform to Twitter, and he labeled it anti-Semitic because on that platform some people voice opinions or say things or write things that are construed as being anti-Semitic by the ADL. Surprise, mm-hmm. Or the Southern Poverty Law, or whatever. And the whole, of course, the point being is that free speech is always going to be anti-Semitic, how they understand it. Because people, if they're free to speak, are going to criticize Jewish organizations, their activism, and the policies they advocate. And a lot of these organizations, whether it's the ADL, the Southern Poverty Law Center, will identify as Jewish organizations as they promote policies. You know, whether it's pro-abortion, transgendered rights, gay marriage, you know, our policy vis-a-vis Israel, advocating Jonathan Pollard being pardoned, you know, these things. And so if you criticize that, you're anti-Semitic. And so that, yeah, free speech will inherently be anti-Semitic, how they understand. The only problem is anti-Semitism is very subjective. So Joe Sobrantz, it used to be an anti-Semite, was someone who didn't like Jews. Now it's someone the Jews don't like, you know.
By the way, you know, Jonathan Pollard's father was in the department at Notre Dame where I got my degree.
Yeah,
in fact, I have some of Morris Pollard's books when he retired. You know, I picked up even his equipment. I picked up some of the stuff they left outside the door.
Yeah, isn't there ample opportunity in like secular or non-Catholic university for Jews to seek employment? They got to work at a Catholic university. But again,
and
this is all part of academic freedom that Hesburgh talked about.
Hesburgh courted him.
Conflicted with the Rockefeller. You know.
Hesburgh actively courted him, and Morris said, Father, I don't know if I would fit in there." and Father Hesburgh said, "Oh, don't worry, Morris. We Catholics, we're trying to fit in as well."
Or he said, "Don't worry, Morris. We won't try to convert you or anything like that."
Yeah, but you know, I remember one day Morris picked me up. I think I was trudging up to campus in the snow. And, I mean, he was a likable fella, you know. Sure, I mean, why would I? And I remember, I mean, he, you know, they say a fanatic is somebody who can't change the subject. I mean, before we got to campus, he was lobbying about his son. And, you know, would I be interested in, you know, joining the fight to get his son released from prison?
So why would the pardoning of Jonathan Pollard, a convicted spy who, you know, reportedly did the most damage to the country's security, why would it be a cause célèbre among Jews to get him pardoned when he's guilty?
Right.
Because he was helping Israel.
Caspar Weinberger, who was ethnically Jewish. He was a member of the Reagan administration. He fought the pardoning of Pollard at that time. Although he was Weinberger was became a Presbyterian. So maybe
the ADL lobbied for I think it was the ADL that lobbied for Pollard to get that position.
Yeah.
Now why isn't any heat put on the ADL? Oh no, it wasn't ADL. I think it was AIPAC. AIPAC did. So, yeah, of course, AIPAC is an agent of the Israeli government. So it's no surprise there, you know, that they would lobby for Pollard to get that position. You know, and why is it that why does he get the pardon and say Aldrich Ames or Walker don't? I mean, it's obviously.
Or Julian Assange or somebody.
Well, Julian Assange, who isn't even American, he's not even an American citizen.
Yeah. I mean,
where do you get off charging that? He's not obligated to. I mean, I don't even think private American citizens are obligated to maintain secrecy laws. You have to sign an agreement for that.
Right.
You know, if you're like they can't, you know. But it's one of these things, you know, whatever that means, national security, government claims. But the point being, again, and then Jonathan Pollard gives an interview where he says that where he exhorts all Jews to do what he did.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, the thing is, and I'm still, you know, if somebody wants to say, oh, you know, Schmidt, he's a hater or Jews or something, I mean, they're wrong. I mean, it's not, I mean, I've worked with Jewish physicians and scientists all my life, and I do admire their intellect. I mean, I resonate with them. I find them interesting to talk to. And so it's just not true. I mean, and by the way, I will consider that a defamation if somebody says that about me. So think we need to start pushing back in
criticism
in these little
is not
ways.
Criticism is not hatred,
right?
You know, it's not attacking. It's not hatred. We're not going in and saying, "Ooh, you know, trying to a secret network to get them fired or anything
right.
like that." You know, that's what they do, actually.
Yes.
No, I would argue
fact,
that.
I think it might have happened to me.
Yeah, I would argue that all things considered, given the unique problem of the Jews, the Jewish question, if you will, that a country can consider certain restrictions given their status. You know, because if you're If you are indeed an agent of Israel, potential agent of Israel, maybe you should deny the security clearance. Or if you do give to AIPAC or you have connections to Zionist organizations, there are legitimate questions about loyalty. It doesn't mean you should deny civil rights, but no one has a civil right to a security clearance or high governmental position. That's right. Ridiculous. That's completely different. Mm-hmm. But we don't, again, we're not allowed to talk about that in polite society.
And by the way, this other point, I do want to applaud you for the role that people like you and E. Michael Jones and Kevin MacDonald have provided in opening up this discussion in a non-rancorous, non-hostile way. I mean, it's the version of who was Obama's, Eric Holder. You know, Eric Holder said, we need to have an honest discussion about race. Well, I've been ready for that one for a long time.
Do you really want an honest discussion?
Yeah. Can we bring in the Jews too? And, no, really. I mean, it should be a healthy, productive thing.
Well, as Catholics, we're called to be fisher of men, to convert the whole world.
Yeah.
Not to say we don't want to do it to the Jews. We might offend them. I mean, one part of, it's a spiritual act of mercy to correct those who are in error, you know.
Yeah.
And if what they're doing is wrong, correct them. Speak to them frankly and honestly. Real dialogue.
Right.
And they don't want dialogue because it's a question of power, you know, at this point. And that's what it is. And so they're not going to engage you. That's why they instead of, debating E. Michael Jones, inviting him to a debate, because they can't stand the scrutiny of a debate in these things. So they shut him. They will try to shut him down. They will try to prevent him from speaking at these places. You know, and that's where if you have Catholics that have a strong sense of Catholic identity, and they act, will cohere and come together as a Catholic community to defend it, then they're strong and the boycotts won't work. The backroom boycotts and the conspiring and the conniving won't work. Just like what happened in Poland with Michael Jones, where the Catholic Church strong and they backed him up, and this tide of gay marriage and degeneracy was pushed back in Poland. You know?
Right.
Because of the strong position of the Catholic Church there. In places where the Church has been weakened and eroded, like Ireland, it was just pushed aside. It was conquered. And same thing with America. America's another story because America, you have the whole issue of Americanism and the Catholic Church.
Right.
And America has always sought itself as a subordinate role, and American Catholics themselves want to do well in society, and they want to climb up the food chain, if you will. Or wheel themselves up the greasy pole of status, and they want, and that's
they had WASP envy.
Yeah, and that's they always want to be at the table, lace curtain Irish. That's that phenomenon. But there's always an inferiority complex, and there's a whole misunderstanding what the church is, what Catholicism in relation to the American Republic, and there's something, America with its pluralistic, pretensions or ideas contradicts church teachings on these things,
You're right.
About the ideal society but this is something that the modern state, we're seeing it's sort of its internal contradictions sort of come apart now with, in Twilight America here with the empire coming apart as it sinks into like utter insanity,
But there is so much that Catholics could truly bring to the table. Like we were talking about immigration before. Well, how about if Catholics would bring to bear on that our understanding of the sins that cry out to heaven? So there's four sins that cry out to heaven, and I can think, just as I'm sitting here off the top of my head, at least two in which the promotion of illegal immigration, actually even legal immigration, mm-hmm. Is a violation of the sins that cry out to heaven. You have the mistreatment of the alien, and you have the mistreatment of the wage earner.
Yes.
And
you can't
so,
have living wages with mass immigration.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And in fact, mass immigration is there to undermine the living wage.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Tim, you're a family man, and I've had you now for almost 2 hours, and there's so much more that we really could be talking about. It's just a treasure chest full of items. So if you're open to it, I hope we can do this again.
Sure, just I'll be happy to.
Well, is there anything that we should think about in closing here as we approach our number two?
Well, what I'm saying that right now this seems to be a scary time. It's a lot of upheaval, and we don't know what's going to come next. There's a lot of concern about, with vaccine mandates, vaccine passports, impending riots. it's come to mean normal and these things. And so it's very, it's a time many people to be fearful, and it's not a time to be fearful. It's not a time to be kind of resolute, and also see the moment as an opportunity, as sort of the oligarchs, I think, in many ways have overextended themselves and revealed themselves too much, where now is an opportunity for millions of more people to be be exposed to what's really going on. This past year, I think, has opened up a lot of eyes, and this is an opportunity. Some say every crisis is an opportunity, and this is an opportunity, again, I think, that which years prior or just a year prior didn't present itself because things appeared to be too normal or quiescent. Unfortunately, it takes a crisis or people to wake a lot of people up to these things. It'd be nice if you could talk to people to convince them to avoid an overall crisis. But it is an opportunity, I think, that they've given us, and it's a chance to sort of make a difference. The reality is that for adults there's conflict and there's threats and as you said, there's predators out there. And our job is to sort of at the same time protect our children, prepare them for the world as it is. There is a line in the show Yellowstone where I think Kevin Costner says to his son, the character Kevin Costner says to his son is that I'm going to paraphrase it now, but it's something that goes like evil wants what it wants. And the challenge in life is being strong enough to resist that evil, defeat that evil, and still enjoy sunrise and love your children. Mm-hmm. And that's the threat. As Christians, as Catholics, we confront in this very hostile world. But the world's always been hostile. So.
Right. And I always like to say that it's good to finish these examinations, and really we've only just begun. I think there's a lot of new ground that has not been covered in other places that we can venture into. And some people tell me, oh, I don't know, Dave, if I can listen. Oh, it's kind of dark. It's a little depressing. And I say, no, the truth really is liberating. When you really see this, you say, oh, that's why it's hurt so long. That's why, I've been sitting on my wallet all this time. That's why it hurts. I see some really positive things. I think because of my discussions with Joe, a group of university students got in touch with me and they asked me to come give a talk. So we spent 3 hours together, dinner, and then I gave them my little spiel. It made me feel like a professor again. But,
well, that's the thing is you want, 100,000, 100 million flowers to bloom and not get cut down. But the idea is the more people do this, I like to think that, there's thousands of people doing a similar thing and they're talking and it's not being, broadcast on CBS News
Right.
Or, you know, or CNN, or it's not a, in a major motion picture release when they used to have those. It's just happening. And that's kind of how these things get going. And we're not given to know how these things turn out. Just we have to, in the meantime, do the right thing, as, you know, and respond as best we can. You know.
And I think too that, as per that article, or, I've been preaching this for a long time. I even used to walk around, Palo Alto Menlo Park area with a t-shirt that said Patriarchy Rising. In fact, if you look online, there is something to that effect. But anyway, we'll come back to that in the future. I think that Catholic men need to quit being so doggone wimpy. They really do. I'm sure you see this in your parishes too. It's like the men defer to the women to organize things. You know, if you try to talk to them and say, "Hey, why don't we get?" "Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know. Should we be doing that? I don't know." It's like they've been, they've just, the word is neutered, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and of course, if you neuter the men and weaken the men, then the women are left indefensible, you know.
Oh, yeah. And then they just get angry.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I think there's a lot more topics. Tim, maybe we'll share some of those on email, and it's something I'll strike your fancy.
Great. Sounds good.
It sure has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is mine. Good night, then.
Good night, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.